I have the pleasure of being joined today by Lars Fruergaard Jørgensen, CEO of Novo Nordisk. As most of you know, Novo Nordisk is a global healthcare company founded in Denmark in 1923 and headquarters just outside Copenhagen. And it is focused on chronic diseases, particularly diabetes and obesity. As it happens, I had the opportunity to work with Novo Nordisk between 1996 and 2000. And back then, it was a relatively small niche company. 25 years later, and in a nutshell, Novo Nordisk is the global leader in diabetes care and obesity care, global number three in hemophilia. It serves every year more than 40 million patients in 170 countries, employing currently 64,000 people around the world, generating revenues of over 30 billion euros and a market capitalization of over 500 billion euros, which makes Novo Nordisk the largest market capitalization in Europe and the 14th in the world as per last week's stock prices. Another way of describing Novo Nordisk's growth since 1996, revenues were multiplied by more than 15 and the stock price by more than 180. That's obviously an extraordinary success story, and I look forward to discussing it. Lars became the company's CEO in 2017. He had joined the company 26 years earlier in 1991 after graduating from Aarhus School of Business. Over the years, Lars has also sat on several boards of directors. He was also named in December 2023 the Financial Times Person of the Year, and he currently serves as the president of the European Federation of Pharmaceutical Industries and Association. Lars, thank you very much, A, for making the time to speak with me, but also for welcoming us in your offices here in Bagsværd.
Yeah, thanks a lot for coming, and it was fascinating to listening to that story. It's a good reminder of how things change over many years, and I look forward to have this discussion.
Now, Lars, a big part of Novo Nordisk's extraordinary growth over the last few years has been the takeoff of second-generation GLP-1 therapies, as they're called. Is it possible for you, for non-specialists, to describe a little bit what's special about these therapies and how they differ from traditional therapies?
Yes, so what we do in Novo Nordisk is typically to work with, say, biology, different mechanisms that we all have ourselves and upregulate that, and that's also the case in GLP-1. So this is a natural, protein, peptide that all of us produce ourselves. And if you make an analog of that, modify a bit the molecular structure, you can actually, increase some of the benefits, and those are both linked to the whole, metabolism and also how you actually digest what you have eaten, but also work in the central nervous system, and in the case of obesity, is actually reducing your appetite, so you eat less, and we are exploring it a number of indications linked to those basic biologies. So it's a multifaceted approach in the body.
Am I correct that they also have some anti-inflammatory properties?
Yes, it's anti-inflammatory, and that's important in its way of reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease.
Right.
So when you have diabetes, for instance, you can build atherosclerotic impact on your whole cardiometabolic system, where your veins get stiffer, so to say. And this anti-inflammatory effect of GLP-1 actually reduces that, and that has led to an evidence of significantly reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease when you use these products.
And we'll come back to this.
Yeah.
But before we do, I want to spend a little bit of time on the previous 20 years of the company's history. When you succeeded your predecessor, Lars Rebien Sørensen, and became CEO in 2017, Novo had been going through a bit of a difficult time. Short period of time, insulin prices in the US had gone down, and of course, because at the time you were so focused on diabetes, Novo Nordisk stock suffered probably a little bit more than other companies. But prior to that, and through Lars Rebien's tenure, Novo Nordisk had done remarkably well in terms of revenues, profit, stock price. Why was Novo Nordisk so successful over these 20 years?
You need to operate in markets where there's a big demand, a large unaddressed market. So that's the case in diabetes and obesity. So picking spaces where you can grow is obviously important. But then also the focus, how you make sure you have capabilities that sets you up to do, say, distinct better than competition, that's really important. Because in our business, we play with really, really low odds at the get-go. So when we start a research program, it perhaps have around 5% likelihood of actually becoming a product that meets one of these unaddressed needs among patients. So how you optimize your odds of success throughout the value chain is really, really important. And you mentioned when Lars Rebien took over, and even his predecessor, Mats Olesen, right. They ran businesses that were broader. And over the years, we left businesses to become more and more focused. And almost every time we did that, we ended up strengthening the core. And that talks a bit to this notion of increasing your odds by really focusing on what you do distinct better right. than others. So we have a very, say, tight strategy map of what are the technologies we master in the company and how do we make sure we master them as good as or better than our competitors, because that improves the odds. And then we apply those technologies up against a set of disease areas where we also have very broad experience. We know the key opinion leaders, we know the prescribers.
Right.
So we can actually develop medicines to those physicians where there's an underlying big patient population behind. And every time we move within this map and go into a new disease area, it has to be an adjacent disease area, so we know something around it, we know some of the prescribers, or if we move on the technology side, we also need to do that in a very disciplined way, because no company was ever successful in going into a new disease area with a new technology.
So you're reminding us that strategy is about where to play and how to win, and you're saying over the years we've been very mindful and deliberate in deciding where to play. Now, one of the aspects is, of course, therapeutical areas. Another aspect is geography. My understanding is that during that period, one of the key decisions was to enter the US market in a relatively big way. And in fact, Novo was successful in going from a relatively small place in the US to a dominating position, essentially between 2000 and 2010. Please tell us a bit more about how you gained that position. It's not like there was no treatment prior to your arrival.
No, that's a key point, and it's a good reminder that I forgot to mention the geographies, because now we are a global company, and that is really, really important, because as I talk about odds and investments into disease areas, if you're not capable of extracting the value of that globally, you also play with lower odds of success, because right. it costs the same for all to develop the right. medicine, but if you cannot commercialize it to all globally, your return on that investment becomes lower, and that means you have less capital to deploy into to new research. So for us, being a Danish origin company, we as a company were strong in Europe, rest of the world, and Lilly all along strong in the US. So the fortune came to us in the form of one of our hemophilia products.
Right.
And it was a long journey in getting it approved in the US, but finally we got it approved to a rare disease, hemophilia, those patients who lived with inhibitors and could not use the classical products. And so it was a life-saving medicine. And that created an opportunity to grow in the US and actually invest significantly in making it. So that funded investment to a large sales force in the US. And then eventually we came in and got our fair share of the US market. And had we not succeeded in doing that, we would probably have partnered our US business.
Okay.
And Novo Nordisk would not be a global company as it is today. And we could not have seen the momentum we have today. And most likely not being in the US, which is half of the global pharmaceutical market, I would doubt we would be a standalone company today.
To what extent did your ownership structure help? So Novo Nordisk shares are publicly traded, but there is a philanthropic foundation that owns about 20 some percent of the shares, but has about, I think, 70% of the votes. To what extent has this been helpful during those 20 years?
It has been fundamental. Throughout my career, I've had different roles. For quite some years, I've been leading corporate development. And in that role, I had many companies coming to visit us to seek a partnership, i.e. acquire the company. And it was typically a short conversation because I could hand them an English translation of the bylaws of the foundation, where it says that their purpose is to own the company, right, and only if it's necessary for the survival of the company can they give up control. And that has not been the case so far. So they sit with, as you say, 27-28% of the shares. Those are A shares carrying 10 votes a share, and then the B shares are listed on the stock market. So we have the really, really long-term perspective from our controlling shareholder, the foundation, and then we have the day-to-day, say, discipline from the capital market. And I think that's a beautiful model for an industry where we have development cycles that are, you know, 20 years or so. And it's an industry where you know, there are different cycles. We just spoke about the insulin cycle that leveled out, and we had some time to then move on to the GLP-1 cycle. And by having that stable ownership, you can ride these waves in a stable way, and having a long-term perspective on how you generate value, really looking at the science and the therapy areas we serve.
So beyond the ownership aspect, one of the things that has struck me as I was researching for this discussion is Novo Nordisk's ability to innovate again and again and again. Now, you've mentioned focus as a key dimension of this ability to innovate. But beyond focus, the impression I have is that Novo Nordisk has developed a very special culture, a very innovative culture, which, if I go back to the Novo Nordisk lore, includes people at lower levels pushing back on management and getting things accepted. So tell us a little bit about the Novo Nordisk innovation culture.
Yeah, it's maybe you should actually ask one of the, you know, researchers, because I might see it slightly different. But I think it being a Danish company, or say a company with some Danish Scandinavian values, I think the power distance is very low, which means that from time to time I have researchers knocking on my door to share their passion and tell me what they believe in. And that helps me build a perspective on what we should be doing. And it's always about the science. You cannot put research on formula. You can do business cases, you can do strategies, and you can assess what is the market opportunity, how many patients are there, and you can perhaps segment it into sub-patient groups. But if you then start to direct science too heavily, most likely you'll get blinded.
Okay.
And typically science shows its face in different ways. So I believe a lot in actually letting the scientists try to unlock the value, get into some early clinical testing, and then see how it works. And then we can connect it with some of the commercial opportunities. But if you put it too much on formula, I think it becomes too much of a top-down directed strategy. We should talk about where we play and how we want to win. But then you have to let science speak its own language and look at the data and then be driven by that. In the area of GLP-1s, there's been a large number of companies who actually developed the GLP-1, but most of them were not really succeeding because they were not differentiated. And when we developed our second generation GLP-1, it was not just the next one in line, it's actually one out maybe 200 different analogs that had been modified using our core capabilities for the optimal pharmaceutical benefit. And then we picked that one and brought it forward. And I think Lilly has some of the same capabilities. So these capabilities, the scientific mindset, and how you let scientists both be directed by a strategy, but giving them the independence to actually do what they believe in is a subtle choice.
And here I'm also hearing also the ability to have a long-term focus, which we already discussed before. Is it also fair to say that Novo Nordisk is a very purpose-driven company with very clear values, openness, accountability and respect, and a Novo Nordisk way, which includes also principles that include never compromise on quality and ethics? Tell us a little bit more about this Novo Nordisk way.
So it's you can say many companies have a set of values, and so do we, but they actually go 100 years back and have lived throughout that period of time. And we do a lot of training of leaders. We evaluate leaders on it. We promote leaders based on it. So I think it's a strength today. I would say close to a competitive edge. And when we recruit people, now I've only worked for one company in Novo Nordisk. When we recruit people and I have an opportunity of meeting them after some time, I always ask them about, so how do you feel about being in Novo Nordisk? And typically, they start talking about something that's about the culture that is being lived, the integrity, whereby we show these values in an everyday manner, which makes me really, really proud and underlines the importance of really, walking the talk from the top on these key aspects.
Do you remember one or two moments where either you or somebody made a decision that was really an important one and that gave a very strong signal on the importance? Because many companies also say we want to have a high quality, patient-centric, people-centric, but very few succeed. So you've already said we recruit, we promote, we train.
But we also dismiss. So I would say both in terms of product development, there's been cases where we simply terminated the development program because we were worried about some safety aspects. And if you each and every time say, okay, we are a patient-centric company, then if there's the slightest doubt about safety, we don't go there. And that makes it easier to make difficult decisions. Right. Same on product quality. If you have the slightest doubt about whether a product was produced in compliance, of course you have to investigate it. But if it turns out that this batch is problematic, well, then people, leaders, local leaders can find guidance in the Nordisk way that we never compromise on quality. So you scrap it. And the same goes for people. When you recruit people, obviously you look for people who express a preference for that type of values, because if it's a leader, it will become more natural for that person to lead that way. But it also means that if you come across leaders who do not show that consistently, many can do the right thing because, you know, you can read the values and you can, you know, play it the right way. But if you don't fundamentally believe in it, you will probably be in situations where you are not living the values.
Right.
And we have ways to detect that. And there's also a speak up culture. And it's found that even, you know, senior leaders are not doing the right thing, that you cannot stay in the company despite very strong business performance.
Thank you for this. That was very helpful. Maybe one last question on this before we move to today. One of the major decisions that was made during those 20 years was indeed to start studying the potential benefits of GLP-1 agonists in the fight against obesity. At the time, and still to some extent today, but certainly at the time, many companies and most observers were looking at obesity as a willpower issue as opposed to a complex pathology. Novo Nordisk, I think, initiated its first clinical trial in this area in 2001, I think. Tell us a little bit more about why the company decided, in fact, we're thinking about it differently and let's see if this works.
Yeah, so at that point of time, there was no real obesity market. So you can say, we spoke about before that there needs to be large addressable markets.
Right.
There was not really a market. And many of the products that had been launched had not succeeded or had been withdrawn from the market because it turned out to have unintended negative side effects.
Right.
So you can say it was a depressing outlook in a way, but we had seen some clinical data that led people to lose weight. And we felt that, okay, if that's the case, there'll be usage of these medicines in weight loss. And that's a bit unethical of us not having studied it. Because if we know one of our products is going to be used in a patient population, we need to make sure that we have studied it, not least in a therapy area where there has been safety issues in the past.
Right.
So we actually owe those patients to have studied it. And then, of course, the upside of being a market, because we also knew that there's a link between overweight and type 2 diabetes,
sure.
And type 2 diabetes being our biggest market, so there's also a way to prevent that. So that led us to do it, but it was not a straightforward, say, choice, because we're worried about actually damaging our diabetes business, because
right.
If we did this development and it did in fact turn out that there were safety issues, then it could destroy the whole category.
Okay.
So I remember the CEO back then, Lars Raben, leaning in and saying that if we have products that will be used in a segment, we have to study it. So that was one of the examples where a CEO can do certain things that the rest of the company can not.
Right.
Lean in and make decisions based on values. And this was, you know, both a business opportunity, but also linking to this this essential saying that we are patient-centric.
Let's focus on today's challenges and opportunities. First challenge and opportunity that comes to mind is an extraordinary ramp up of capacity. And of course, the world is hoping that you can ramp up capacity as fast as possible, but also as slowly as necessary, right? Because this is pharma and there are clearly quality and regulatory and compliance issues that you need to take into account. So please tell us about first the physical side of the expansion. What's needed? How fast can you go? And what percentage of the market can you ultimately handle by yourself?
Yeah, so we today serve maybe 1 or 2 million people living with obesity, and some forecasts say that there's a billion, depending a bit on is it today or in a few years, but it's a huge market. We know from diabetes that many are not diagnosed,
right.
Many do not get treatment. The dynamics around obesity is a bit different because most are aware. And so we see a huge urge for being on treatment. And it's interesting, back to our discussion about when did we start development, that we were biased by our own experience with the first generation product that delivered a lower weight loss, not really enough to really make patients excited and physicians excited. So we had not seen this growth coming. So when we launched the second generation product, delivering significantly more than 10%, which is probably the threshold for patients and physicians to be excited, we saw this steep uptake. And then we had to get going on building more capacity. It takes for the core ingredient, the so-called API, active pharmaceutical ingredient, it takes perhaps 5 years to build such a factory. So you think about it, takes maybe a year to prepare such a project. You have to have it approved, and then it's ready 5 years later. So right now we are building a number of such API factories. And after you have produced the API, you need to do fill finish. So it's sterile liquid products going into a glass container and into a device. Such a factory also takes another, say, 4 years to build. So massive CapEx program, and we don't really comment on how many patients we believe we can serve, because that's highly confidential. But even that program will only be a fraction of the total addressable market. So typically, after we build these factories, comes a lot of optimizations. We improve throughput, so we can drive up yields. So. You mentioned the 40 million patients we serve today. We grew that by 5 million in 1 year. So if you can, you know, imagine if we in the coming years can add another 5 million year over year, that's going to be a large number of patients we can serve.
Expansion possibilities are almost infinite.
They are, because if you have a disease area where the patient population is a sizable part of the total world. And perhaps that trend will continue, so it will be an even larger share of the world population. That's exciting from a business point of view, right. But obviously also from a health point of view, because obesity is a gateway to through to a number of other diseases. So if we can prevent those, that's a very meaningful thing to do.
Now, there's also a human side to the expansion. Over the last, I think, 2 years, you've added 20% of new employees, which is quite significant. How do you go about ensuring that they absorb and internalize this Novo Nordisk way that we discussed a minute ago?
Yeah, that's a key challenge. And many of them have been recruited in